This is Culturetopia, your weekly roundup of the very best arts and culture stories from NPR. I am Netta Ulaby, NPR's arts reporter.
And I'm Linda Holmes, writer and editor of NPR's arts and entertainment blog, Monkey See.
A reminder, you can subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. This week,
David Simon, the creator of The Wire, returns to television with a new show about New Orleans, Treme.
Writer Ian McEwan goes to the Arctic for some novelistic inspiration.
And we remember one of the seminal figures of the punk era, Malcolm McLaren. But first,
Kitty Kelly is a biographer. She's controversial, prolific, and she's written some unflattering tell-alls about some famous Americans, including Frank Sinatra, Elizabeth Taylor, Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis, and both George Bushes. But now, Kitty Kelly has dared to scrutinize the life of Oprah Winfrey. Karen Grigsby Bates has this report.
Oprah Winfrey comes into American living rooms every weekday. But as much as Winfrey talks to other people, she's famous for not allowing people who know or work for her to talk about her. Her strict non-disclosure mandates are legendary. Winfrey no longer gives interviews that she can't control, and when asked for comment on Kitty Kelly's book, her spokeswoman, Lisa Halliday, gave NPR the same one-line response that has been given to everyone else who inquired. Oprah hasn't participated in or read Kitty Kelly's book, so she is unable to comment. Follow-up questions were ignored. So writer Kitty Kelly was faced with a considerable task when she decided to do an unauthorized biography of daytime television's Queen of Talk. Kelly said Winfrey was intriguing in part because she was such a huge challenge, a bigger challenge even than the members of a powerful political dynasty.
I didn't just jump into this project. I really wanted to do a full-dimensional biography, and Oprah Winfrey was the only life story I wanted to do after the Bushes.
Kelly says getting her publisher to sign on to the project wasn't easy. After all, beginning in 1996, the Oprah Winfrey Book Club had been a crucial shot in the arm for the publishing industry for more than a decade. An Oprah endorsement can sell millions of copies. And it's not just good for books. She stumped for Barack Obama in 2008 at the Iowa caucuses.
So much has been said about what my jumping into this arena does or does not bring to the table of politics. I really don't know.
Eventually, Kelly got a green light for the book, but Winfrey, like Kelly's other celebrity subjects, wouldn't agree to be interviewed. So if the subject herself isn't going to talk, how do you do it?
For this book, although I interviewed 850 people, and I did not personally interview Oprah Winfrey, the biggest source of information in the book and the best source of information was Oprah herself.
Kelly began gathering information from thousands of Winfrey's past public utterances.
I spent about a year assembling every interview the woman ever gave in the United States and the United Kingdom in the English language on radio, television, newspapers, and magazines.
She also got two of Winfrey's family members, her stepfather Vernon and her cousin Catherine Carr Esters, to speak, and had photos taken with them and included in the book as confirmation. Oprah, a biography, doesn't contain any explosive revelations, but it does flesh out many of the things Winfrey has mentioned about her past. The sexual abuse she said she endured as a child, a traumatic adolescent pregnancy, a heavy flirtation with drugs, and the nature of the relationship with best friend Gail King. Kelly did do a two-part interview with Matt Lauer on Monday and this morning on the Today Show, but David Drake, spokesman for her publisher, Crown Books, a division of Random House, says rumors that other media outlets have declined interviews are true. Drake won't name names, but reportedly ABC is one of them. ABC's parent company, Disney, is partnering with Winfrey in several of the new shows she'll present on the Oprah Winfrey Network.
If they're deciding the merits of a book's newsworthiness on the basis of whether or not it might offend one of their corporate partners, it's an abdication of the primacy of letting the news value dictate the news.
NPR's media correspondent, David Folkenflik, says that's a sign of how interconnected much of modern media has become. Random House is betting that readers will be braver than some media outlets have been. Their initial run of Kelly's Oprah book is 550,000 copies. Karen Grigsby Bates, NPR News.
Well, Oprah is formidable.
She is indeed. So is David Simon.
He is indeed formidable. David Simon, the writer who explored Baltimore on HBO's The Wire, has turned to another city. Tremé takes its name from a neighborhood in New Orleans. The show takes place in the months following Hurricane Katrina and follows ordinary New Orleans citizens as they attempt to rebuild their lives and community. While the show's cast of characters includes a chef, a disc jockey, a lawyer, and a Mardi Gras Indian, at its heart is the music of the city, jazz. NPR's Steve Inskeep recently spoke with David Simon and actor Clark Peters about the origins of the series and how they tried to capture the true culture and vibrant spirit of the city.
The city came back on the weight of culture. There was no political leadership that stood up. There was no socioeconomic reason that New Orleans had to return. I mean, this city came back over the last 5 years. One trombonist, one sous chef, one Mardi Gras Indian, one social aid and pleasure club member at a time.
I'm looking for George Cottrell. He ain't been back. Keeping an eye on his house, though, till he comes home. You heard from him?
Nah.
Any idea where he at?
My cousin says Oklahoma City.
Oklahoma City? Man.
Yeah, right. He'll be back, though. Get tired of eating that food.
You hear from him? Tell him his chief is looking for him.
Big Chief Lambro, huh? I heard Judge talk about you.
Clark Peters, let's talk about your character, Lambro, who returns to New Orleans as soon as he can after Hurricane Katrina. His home is utterly demolished, and yet he asked to be dropped off there. He's not going to go back out of the city again. And he's a Mardi Gras Indian who dresses up for parades. Quite a character.
Yes. To say he just dresses up for parades is really minimizing a tradition that has gone on for hundreds of years. Mardi Gras Indians is probably more important to America and to the African-American community than they know. Because this is a part of New Orleans that isn't girls gone wild on Bourbon Street. You know, it's a lot deeper than that.
New Orleans is its own creature, and for those that wade in with sort of an indifference to all its nuances, God help you. I mean, I'll be honest. When it comes to the show Tremé, I'm not afraid of any audience outside of New Orleans. I don't care what anyone else thinks, and it's hard to explain it sometimes to the outside world. I mean, how do you explain the Mardi Gras Indians, which is basically a working class African-American phenomenon of African-Americans masking as Native Americans on Mardi Gras Day and creating an entire subculture that is at the point of being its own religion at this point? Or how do you explain the Zulu Parade on Mardi Gras Day, which had its origins as a very sarcastic black response to white Mardi Gras crews parading? You know, you come to New Orleans and you're not ready for it, and suddenly this float comes down the street and it's full of African Americans who are in blackface. Louis Armstrong was the king of Zulu in 1947, and when Eleanor Roosevelt saw him in Life magazine, she called him up and said, you know, Mr. Armstrong, what are you doing? You're setting back your race. And he had to say, ma'am, I don't know what to tell you, but I'm the king of Zulu. I don't know what your problem is, but they've made me the king of Zulu, you know, and I couldn't be more proud. It's my hometown.
I get a sense watching an early episode of Tremé that you're not even worried too much about explaining all the nuances of this. You're just trying to present it accurately, and I'm going to dive in as a viewer and get it or not.
Well, you know, there's two ways of being a tourist. The first way is you get on the tour bus and the guide grabs the microphone and you drive down the streets that everyone's driven down before, and he tells you, you know, when this church was built, and then you go in for 15 minutes and you come out again and you go to the next country. And then there's the other way, which is when you go somewhere for a while and you don't have a tour guide and you walk into the nearest bar or shebeen and you just be, and you start figuring out a place from the people up. And the way we try to do television is that way, which is to say exposition is pretty soul-killing and denies the fact that people have a right to live their lives without explaining it to you, the viewer, first. And it trusts that the viewers are intelligent.
You can hear the entire interview with David Simon and Clark Peters, as well as much more coverage of Tremé and New Orleans, at our website, npr.org/culturetopia.
Writer Ian McEwan's latest literary venture began in deep freeze. He joined a group of artists and scientists on a week-long sea voyage in the Arctic. This was part of a British-based project called Cape Farewell. The idea is to inspire culture makers, painters, photographers, authors, even dancers, to contemplate climate change. But as NPR's Lynn Neary reports, McEwen was struck by something else, that even the best of intentions can go awry in the hands of human beings.
Over dinner one night, he told his shipmates that the chaos that had overtaken the room where all their gear was stored seemed a perfect metaphor for human frailty.
All it needs is one mistake, and then there's a domino effect. Someone saying, well, damn it, you know, I'll take those boots because someone took my boots. And you actually have a social contract. Total collapse. The boot room now is just a scene of total lack of cooperation. Environmentalists who care about the planet can't even get their boots together.
Before going to the Arctic, McEwen had been interested in the issue of climate change, but couldn't figure out a way to write a novel about it without sounding too preachy. Something about the disarray in the ship's boot room gave him an idea.
And it seemed to strike a chord with a lot else that I'd understood about climate science, the politics of it, and human institutions, that we're very good at making wide and sweeping statements of intent. But once we get down to it, often very little happens. And that was at least it gave me the first suspicion that maybe the route into this was through comedy, a comedy of human nature.
That boot room scene eventually made its way into McEwen's new novel, Solar. His main character, Michael Beard, takes a similar journey to the Arctic. Beard doesn't really care that much about climate change. He just wants to get away from the chaos of his own life. He falls under the spell of the Arctic and his amiable companions, but he finds that messy boot room irritating.
That morning, he saw several snowmobile suits also on the floor. They had a trampled appearance, and he decided, without looking too closely, that none could be his. Pickett admitted to him, while they were out recording the sound of the wind in the ship's rigging, that for 2 days he had been wearing two left boots. But he was a hardy sort who did not seem to mind. Beard did mind.
Beard is invited on the Arctic journey because he's a Nobel Prize-winning physicist. McEwen says he knew he had to write about a Nobel winner after being introduced to some of these scientific giants at a conference.
And I've never been in a room bristling with such powerful egos. I mean, these guys are grand. And it was at that point I thought, if I ever get round to writing a novel about climate science, I definitely have to award a Nobel Prize to my principal character.
Michael Beard may have the towering ego of a Nobel Prize-winning scientist, but he is also deeply flawed. A womanizer who has cheated on all of his many wives, he eats too much, drinks too much, and has virtually no moral compass. As for his scientific accomplishments, he lives off the laurels of his past glory. His foray into the science of climate change is spurred on by a bizarre accident that offers him an opening to steal someone else's ideas. Beard, says McEwen, represents all of us at our worst.
He's somewhat lazy, rather greedy, full of resolutions to give up eating junk food and lose weight and get fit. Sort of believes in climate change, but skeptically can't be bothered to get too interested in it until an opportunity presents itself. And then he sees a chance to both save the world, make his name, and to make some money.
McEwen says this farcical portrayal of a scientist loaded down with bad habits is his way of depicting how difficult it is for spoiled, lazy, self-centered human beings to take on the challenges required to reverse the effects of climate change. And despite, or maybe even because of his many flaws, Beard was a fun character to create.
It's interesting to have such a wildly erroneous guy at the center of things. I could get him to say and do things that maybe I wouldn't if I was trying to make a climate science novel and have a paragon of virtue at its center, which I think would be awfully dull.
Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
With more than 24 books to his credit, Walter Mosley has placed unforgettable black characters at the center of American fiction, as lovers, as thugs, as bad guys and good guys, and of course, guys who are a little of each. Mosley's latest work, Known to Evil, is just out. It's the second novel starring Private Eye Leonard McGill, chasing a killer in contemporary New York City. Mosley recently spoke with NPR's Michelle Martin, and she asked him about the book's main character and his search for redemption.
Now, is redemption inherently interesting to you?
Yeah, I think that redemption is the history of the Western world, starting with Christianity and going before it. I mean, we're all seeking redemption. That's the weight that's put on every single human being.
And the love relationships are complicated in this one. Let me just try to unpack it. Leonid, who is black, is married to Katrina, who's white. They haven't been faithful to each other for years. And in fact, as the novel opens, I don't think I'm giving too much away, but Leonid is nursing a broken heart because his girlfriend, who's another kind of interesting mix, has dumped him for another man. And he realizes,
well, she hasn't dumped him. He stopped being with her when his wife came back because he felt that's what he should be doing, this whole notion of redemption.
And I mentioned the race of each of these characters just because I just think it's so interesting. I mean, you've really created these unforgettable characters in some of these earlier series whose African-American-ness is central in some ways, not so central in some ways. But in this series and in this novel in particular, the relationships, the identities are all over the place. And I'm just wondering, what's that like? Is it easier in a way emotionally to kind of open up the spectrum? Is it harder in some ways?
Well, you know, the other day I was asked by a journalist about a black writers conference. I was asked, is it valuable to have a black writers conference in post-racial America? And you know, my response is, of course, well, we don't live in post-racial America or post-racial anything else. But it is true that we kind of live in a meta-racial state where race is kind of raised up kind of ethereally above the clay of our bodies and blended and enmeshed in itself, and that there's things are so complex and culture is so complex and how we deal with each other is so complex that it's hard to tell who is who and what is what. So, but in everyday talk, it all comes out. You know, one of the things you didn't say is that of the three children that Leonid and Katrina have, two of them were not fathered by Leonid. She says they were, but they weren't. One is the daughter of a Burmese jeweler, and one is a daughter of some African that she had an affair with. They're not his kids. You can look at them and see they're not his kids. But they are his kids. Twill is his favorite son.
And you can hear Michelle Martin's full interview with Walter Mosley at npr.org/culturetopia.
Florence Welsh has become a sensation since she was discovered singing in the bathroom of a London pub. Her critically acclaimed debut album is called Lungs, and it's sold more than 1 million copies in the UK. Now, with a second album in the works, the 23-year-old is on her first U.S. tour with her band, Florence and the Machine. Welsh's primal voice can turn from delicate to fiercely urgent in an instant. She also plays piano and drums in the studio and occasionally on stage. Welsh describes her music as a juxtaposition of the imaginary and the physical.
You hit me once, I hit you back. You gave a kick, I gave a slap. You smashed a plate over my head, then I set fire to our bed. You hit me once, I hit you back. You gave a kick, I gave a slap. You smashed a plate over my head.
Melissa Block caught up with Florence Welsh, and they talked about how she writes her music.
The song, A Kiss with a Fist.
Yes.
Tell me about that song. How'd it come about?
I just wrote it when I was like 17. It was because I was hanging out with loads of garage punk bands, and they were kind of my first influences, and I guess I wanted to write a love song that was like as tough as like their song.
A kiss with a fist is better than none.
There's no victims in the song. It was kind of a metaphor for first love and it's all in all its intensities.
A broken jaw once before, I spilled your blood upon.
There's such an extreme feeling to be in love, especially in a quite emotionally destructive relationship where you're both kind of really bad for each other but you love each other so much. Those extreme emotions, I think, can only be described with extreme imagery. You know, that's how you feel. You feel, even though there's no actual physical violence there, you just feel so conflicted. It is like you're sort of tearing each other apart.
Let's take a listen to one of the songs on the CD called Cosmic Love.
Your heart and landed in my arms.
Florence, I notice as you're listening to this, you're trying to bang on something right now. You're shaking your head.
It's because it's so simple, that whole chord thing. I wrote it in 10 minutes, and I don't know where it came from. It's the most magical song. It appeared when I had the most awful hangover I've ever had.
That really happens, huh?
Oh, yeah, I thought okay. I was going to die. I was lying on the floor of the studio. I was like, oh, God, I feel so ill. And then suddenly, dun 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 dun. Dun 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 dun. Dun 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 dun. Oh, my God. That sounds good. What is that? Where did that come from? And then the whole thing, just that boom, 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 boom. I can't play anything, really. And so when something works, you just got to follow it, no matter how simple it is. And the whole song's completely simple and written in half an hour. And then we got drunk again.
I think you joined a pantheon of musical greats who probably wrote in much the same circumstances.
I wouldn't recommend it, is what I'm saying. I took the stones from Mars and
then I made a map. Somewhere in there, a harp enters the picture.
Well, we just kind of saw this guy walking past the studio holding what looked like a telephone box wrapped in a blanket. And I was like, oh, what's that? What's that? And it was a harp. So we figured, why not get him in to actually play it, and it sounded so great that we just decided to use it on everything. And then we never thought we'd be able to actually have it in the band, but then he was really up for coming and playing.
What do you think it adds to the song?
My style of playing is more enthusiasm and instinct than skill, so it really helps, I think, to have someone who has that lightness of touch and that skill. It adds a depth to it.
There's more music by Florence and the Machine on our website, npr.org.
And speaking of music, Malcolm McLaren was known as the British Andy Warhol, the P.T. Barnum of punk, and a Dick Clark from hell. The music producer and provocateur died last week of cancer in Switzerland. He was 64. Netta, you produced this remembrance. Let's take a listen.
It's not easy to be the most hated man in punk rock, but for years, Malcolm McLaren somehow managed. In 1977, McLaren was running a shop that sold fetish gear with his then-girlfriend, Vivian Westwood, who'd go on to become a famous designer. Two young toughs, the story goes, used their shop to fence stolen music equipment. McLaren thought they'd be perfect for a band, the Sex Pistols. God save the queen, the fascist regime. Malcolm McLaren was less a student of rock and roll than of the twin mechanics of promotion and provocation. Here's what he told WHYY's Fresh Air in 1988.
It really was about swindling your way to the top of a record industry, which is really founded on a great deal of hype. It was a swindling by really deciding not to play, really deciding sometimes not to even be played on the radio. It didn't matter that you couldn't hear it. It was the attitude. No future, no future,
no future for you. While the Sex Pistols actually became an influential group, that attitude, the look, the pose, seemed most important to McLaren. His first stab at rock management came with the band the New York Dolls, who he loved for their trashy transvestite image. Like so many other British music conceptualists, McLaren sprang from art school with a finely honed sense of subversion. He loved the French situationists and their slogans, like, what are the politics of boredom? And for him, pushing buttons and manipulating the media was an art form.
The idea of painting in an attic, as I was taught to do for 8 years in art school, seemed the wrong process. And I decided to use people like sculptors use clay.
Something always oddly cold about Malcolm, frankly. His view of life as art didn't seem to have too much heart in it, one always felt.
Chris Salovich is a music writer who's covered the punk scene from the very beginning. I reached him at an opening in London filled with former punk artists and musicians.
We're all all a bit shocked. Seriously, we've just been talking here about this. He was a kind of difficult kettle of fish, but all of us have just said that we wouldn't be here without him.
Nonetheless, Salovich says Malcolm McLaren deserved his reputation as an exploitative Svengali. Take Sid Vicious, the embodiment of the punk scene's excesses. The Sex Pistols bassist overdosed after he allegedly murdered his girlfriend.
Sid Vicious need not have declined in the way that he did. One always felt that Malcolm almost encouraged this as part of the whole scam of the Sex Pistols.
Still, somehow, McLaren seemed to anticipate trends. World music, hip-hop, mashups, even something like opera.
Take it away, Kyoto.
Malcolm McLaren left a big, messy tag that runs through the last quarter century of popular culture. His greatest legacy was a do-it-yourself ethos, a perverse determination for people to commercialize their most unconventional impulses.
Being good is not the idea. Being bad is what's more exciting, you see.
Netta Ulaby, NPR News. And that's it for this week.
You can find links to all the stories we had today and subscribe to the podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. I'm Linda Holmes.
And I'm Netta Ulaby. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.